Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive people from India and Australia will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us news that's too often missed by mainstream media. Why cyberspace is becoming crime's new frontier. When downloading films and music can land you in jail. And how the United States is leaning on world governments to export their cyber criminals to them. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. And before we meet today's co-hosts, who are both experts in the law of cyberspace, let's first visit the earthly home of the man who inspired today's program. It's on the central coast of New South Wales in Australia. Neil Griffiths is inviting us there to share a cup of tea over a phone line chat so he can tell us about his son, Hugh Griffiths, currently serving a 51-month sentence for participating in a group that cracked company codes to enable him to download software and media products free of the normal charges. It's a remarkable case, highlighting how anyone who breaches US company copyrights, no matter where they are in the world, could potentially be raided, extradited to North America, and thrown in an overcrowded prison for, in Hugh's case, more than 4 years. So, Neil, tell us about Hugh.
Well, he's 44 and he went to uni. He speaks fluent Spanish, which he learned when he was very young. Over ham radio. Then he went to live in Sydney and he got work down there. He was very busy actually, but then he lost his job and he came to live with me when I needed him. I had a deep vein thrombosis in my leg and needed somebody with me. So it worked out quite well. And he's a very helpful sort of person. He wanted to be a translator and interpreter, but then there were no jobs, so this is why he had to go and work in pubs and things like this and do his other little jobs. And he fairly respective, I suppose, because I was a single parent. Just when he needed his mum, she wasn't around, so he sort of got a bit withdrawn.
So you were 10-pound migrants to Australia when Hugh was only 7 years old.
Oh, he was only 7 years.
And as I understand it, your wife left you with the kids when Hugh was about 8 years old, was that right?
About that, yes.
And you brought up two children, and Hugh's now 44.
Yeah.
Tell us about Hugh's involvement with the group Drink or Die. It's an internet software piracy group alleged to have 60 members worldwide, and Hugh was alleged to be a leader of that group, cracking security codes and downloading music, videos and software, worth, they say, $60 million.
This is a fictitious figure, I'm sure, because on the documents that came from the States, it was about a million or something, or far, far less than $60 million.
I mean, you said that Hugh didn't make any money out of this. Is there any way that he could have and you wouldn't know about it?
No way at all.
Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, he had to borrow money from me sometimes to get his cigarettes. In fact, I almost cut him off smoking because a packet a day is just too much to have a packet a week. But the point is, he didn't sell anything as far as I know, and he was only a co-leader with a person in the United States who was being encouraged by the FBI, being paid to encourage people to give their addresses and where they were and things like this, which is the reason why he finally got arrested.
Well, that must have been a remarkable experience, Neil. As I understand it, it was December 2001, just after September 11, and all of a sudden it's 3 a.m. and you're raided by seven Australian police officers and one FBI agent. Tell us what actually happened.
this time in the morning, I mean, you wake up and you wonder why all the lights are shining on your windows and people are banging on the door. They all sort of trooped in together, and the FBI guy walked over to the computer and complained that it wasn't working. And
3 a.m.
One of the Australian Federal Police said, well, you have to switch it on, you know. Searched the house, and they took all the hard drives and the computer and all the CDs that we had, and what you had, I should say, most of which had been sent to him anyway, because there's no way he could copy them. There's no way he could have downloaded all the things that were there, because there's no broadband or anything then, you know.
Why 3 a.m. in the morning, though?
Well, I mean, the people in England and Scandinavia and all over the place, they wanted everybody around the world to be attacked at the same time, because otherwise somebody might get in touch with somebody else and they'd get rid of everything or hide in the garden.
Yes, there was a wide range of countries, wasn't there? The War Is campaign conducted by the US involved a scrutinisation of some 60 countries who were housing residents who allegedly were breaking US company copyrights. They must have been wanting to set a real example by this operation. What do you know about Drink or Die?
Drink or Die was originally started in Russia, and there's no connection between Hugh and them, because that was years before he got onto it. There's a great big list of things they're supposed to have cracked.
Mm.
John Sank has led and managed Drink or Die. He's a guy in the States. Pat Buccaneer, he called himself.
Now, he's supposed to have been the first person that the FBI found who turned and actually informed on the rest of the group members. Is that right?
As far as I know, yes. He initially had 46 months in prison. They reduced it to 18 months instead of 46.
And then 2 years supervised release.
Yeah,
right.
It was helping the Americans discover where people live so they could come and raid them, you see.
And what about the other members of this computer code-cracking group, Drink or Die? What happened to them, Neil?
There's pages and pages of it off the net with people who've had sentences which have been reduced to virtually nothing when you look at it. So many of them. I mean, got pages and pages. Oh, here we are. Barry in Buccaneer. Provided pre-release Symantec software to various groups, 33 months in prison, reduced in November to 15 months, 2 years supervised release. Anthony Buccaneer participated in various groups, POPs and Drink or Die, 2 years probation, 6 months home confinement, electronic monitoring, 150 hours community service.
So that's not even a prison sentence.
Oh.
Right. Well, you must wonder about the even-handedness of these particular sentences. Why your son cops such a high sentence, 51 months, more than 4 years incarceration, compared to the sentences that you've just read out?
Well, there are three others here. One got 2 years probation, $500 fine. One got 12 months probation, $500 fine. 2 years probation, 150 hours community service.
And are they American residents, or are they from other countries?
Well, as far as I know, these are all Americans.
Mm. What's your view about why your son has been incarcerated, Neil?
The fact that he committed the crime here means that he could have been charged here. He was quite willing to plead guilty and supply information and help them, but apparently the Americans wanted him, and so the government thought it would be better if they went to America. And he got bail for the first time he went for his appeal. And we thought that was it, you know, and they'd probably take him to court here and have a beer, because, you know, it wasn't such a bad crime here.
This is the most remarkable part about this case, I think, that it's actually about a person in Australia breaking the US laws. Has he been charged with anything over in Australia?
No, never.
The Australian government has negotiated a free trade agreement with America, a bilateral agreement. And many countries around the world have done or are doing the same thing. And within that free trade agreement is often included the need to protect copyright owned by US companies. And it's been enthusiastically endorsed by the Australian government, who have actually helped by extraditing a person who has lived in this country for over 30 years into the hands of the American authorities, and allowed the American courts to try him and to punish him. This is an example of what might happen to other people around the world who sign such trade agreements. What have you heard back from the legal profession in Australia about their views of what's actually taken place, Neil? And what are your thoughts about what's taken place?
Well, every legal person who gets into this, not just in Australia, but all around the world, say that it's absolutely ridiculous, you know. I think that if people commit a crime in their own country, they should be tried in their own country. I feel that there's no reason whatsoever that they couldn't have been charged and fined or whatever they wanted to do here, because this is where he committed the crime. The point is that if some country has a law where you can't ride a bike barefoot, and you're picked up by the police here and you're riding barefoot, and they say, oh, look, so-and-so wants to extradite him to Yongabala, where they're not allowed to ride barefoot. Send him over there, you know. They can send him to prison. Because this is the attitude, really.
And it has to be said that out of the many countries which had nationals that were part of this exercise by America to scoop up those people around the world who were in organised groups cracking security codes for copyright, Hugh is the only one who's been extradited from the protection of one country into America. And as a consequence, as I understand it, Hugh is now in a cell in Virginia, a cell designed for two people that's actually housing three men. Tell us about the conditions that you know that your son is facing at the moment in that jail in Virginia.
Well, on the previous one, I imagine this one will be the same. He had to pay for everything he had. He had to buy his songs. All they got was a T-shirt and one of these cotton suits that everybody wears. They had to pay for his joggers. When they leave there, they have to turn them in and buy some new ones when they go to the next legal place. And
sorry, Neil, to interrupt you. Where does Hugh get the money for that?
It's well, I'd send him probably 30% of my pension. It's the only way to do it because he could have no coffee. The food was not sort of overwhelmingly fruitful. He was hungry and everything he had to pay for. I mean, if you had to see a doctor, he had to pay. If you needed a nurse, he had to pay. So any help you wanted, you had to pay for.
So that includes medical attention as well?
Well, apparently, yes. And he had no warm clothes. I couldn't set him in warm clothes. And he was there in the winter. It's freezing. So, you know, it's pretty terrible, really.
And what's your current financial situation, Neil?
I'm on an age pension.
And how about Hugh?
He has no income. He had no money.
Mm.
I mean, he didn't make any money out of what he was doing. And he only had the unemployment because he couldn't get a job.
It's been a whirlwind for him, hasn't it? Being placed before the US courts,
actually
pleading guilty and being incarcerated in overcrowded conditions away from his family, his loved ones, including you and your daughter. What's his spirit like? What does he say to you about?
So he tries to be up rather than down, but he does suffer from depression.
And there's a special overlay on Hugh's case too, Neil, one that's really unfortunate. Even though you and Hugh had lived in Australia for 31 years, when the FBI raided your home back in 2001, you were both still on permanent resident visas rather than on Australian passports. The Australian government now says that Hugh's permanent resident visa lapsed when they extradited him. So now, after finishing his prison sentence in the US, he might not be able to get back to his home in Australia. What's happening there now?
He was taken away on a one-way US visa. So he has to get a British passport and then get an Australian passport somehow, which everybody's working on very hard.
And there is a possibility he might not get an Australian passport now because of this?
Well, this is a possibility which we hope won't occur.
Mm.
I've applied for Australian citizenship and it's been granted, but I assume I'm not an Australian citizen. I was a permanent resident and permanent doesn't seem to mean permanent anymore.
So you said that Hugh apparently was very interested in ham radios. He was very interested when he was a child about exploring other people and other shores outside Australia when he was a kid.
Yeah.
Tell us about those conversations.
He obviously got in touch with people and had a talk with them. And he went to somebody in South America and he used to have two lessons a day in Spanish, which was very useful. Everybody he got in touch with would send a card with their ham radio number on and he'd go in touch with him and send a card or something. A couple of shoeboxes for them, you know. So he must have talked to a lot of people. He just liked getting around the world.
Yeah. And did he do the same thing on the computer?
Well, I imagine this is what happened initially. I'm sure he's persuaded to do what happened and why he's in the United States now.
In the last conversation you had with your son, who is sitting in a prison cell at the moment in Virginia, what was the conversation about, Neil? What is worrying Hugh at the moment and what is on his mind?
Well, he's worried about when he's going to come home.
And he can talk freely with you, can he? You can communicate with him. There's a time difference, of course, which is quite substantial, about 15 hours, actually.
No, this was just one call which he was allowed to make at 4:00 in the morning. And somebody arranged for him to call me because he understood I had to have a cataract removed and he's a bit concerned.
Have you any plans to go over and see him?
Well, no, because I'm not allowed to fly because I had deep brain thrombosis.
It's been great talking with you today, Neil. Thank you very much for having a cup of tea with me.
A pleasure.
That was Neil Griffiths, speaking from his home on the central coast of New South Wales in Australia about his son, Hugh Griffiths. Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, having just talked to Hugh Griffiths' dad. Hugh's serving out a 4-year jail term in Virginia in the United States after being convicted of crime in cyberspace. And his dad, Neil, has just been filling us in about the many issues Hugh's case raises. And expect to see more cases like this around the world. Why do I say this? Well, because these kinds of prosecutions are now a priority for the United States. I want to share with you excerpts from the prepared remarks of Attorney General John Ashcroft when he released the report of the Department of Justice's Task Force on Intellectual Property in October 2004 in the United States. In it, he revealed the much more aggressive stance that the United States planned to take to people who infringe the intellectual property rights of its companies. He said, and I'm going to quote now, "Intellectual property is one of America's greatest resources. From the music we enjoy, to the movies we watch, to the software and technology that fuels the information age, intellectual property is found in every aspect of our lives. It represents a substantial and vital part of the American economy. As intellectual property's value to our economy has become more important, however, the theft of this national resource has become epidemic. The theft of America's intellectual property threatens our economy. Intellectual property theft threatens our citizens' health and safety. Intellectual property theft threatens our security." A recent International Intellectual Property Alliance study reported that copyright industries alone employ more than 5 million Americans, representing 4% of America's workforce. These industries contribute $626 billion to the US economy. That's 6% of our nation's gross domestic product. And that's Attorney General John Ashcroft quoting there, not me. That's 6% of the United States nation's gross domestic product, exceeding the total GDP of such countries as Argentina, the Netherlands, and Taiwan. Yet the jobs intellectual property creates, from movie set construction workers to software designers and pharmaceutical researchers, and the economic growth it generates, are increasingly imperiled by theft of the innovation and hard work of American minds and hands. The Motion Picture Association of America estimates that more than 2.6 billion songs, movies, and software programs are illegally distributed over the internet. Overall, the US Trade Representative now estimates that intellectual property theft worldwide costs United States companies $250 billion annually. The Attorney General of the United States then went on to list a series of measures that he described as the most aggressive, ambitious, and far-reaching law enforcement effort ever taken against intellectual property crimes. He said that geographic borders do not limit intellectual property theft and counterfeiting, and borders must not limit the United States' investigation, prosecution, and prevention effort against such crime. That's the end of the excerpts from US Attorney General Ashcroft's speech. And like the Attorney General, we're not going to let borders limit our perspectives today. Our next two guests are both lawyers from different sides of the globe. Both are experts in intellectual property and cyberspace. And both make recommendations to government about how to improve intellectual property laws. But their advice is driven by different policy directions, something that we're keen to focus on today. Lawrence Liang is the legal lead for Creative Commons in India, a non-profit organisation that encourages people to share information. Professor Andrew Christie is the founding director of the Intellectual Property Research Institute of Australia at the University of Melbourne, and he's been advising governments about a more protective approach. While we're going to be concentrating today on cybercrime, let's leave that to one side for just a moment and start off with some basic general concepts. In simple terms, what is intellectual property and why is it important? How about you dive in first, Andrew?
No worries. Anything that's the product of the human intellect is probably going to be intellectual property. That's why we use those terms, intellect for intellectual and property, something that can be owned by an individual. Most common examples are items of popular culture that people consume every day, music on CDs, films on the screen, books in their hand. All of those are subject matters created by an individual's intellect and to which the law gives private rights of ownership.
How do you think that intellectual property can be described as affecting ordinary people's lives, the lives of people like you and me?
Well, I think it does it in two ways. Firstly, we hope, because this is the rationale for having intellectual property laws, we hope that the laws encourage people to create. So they recognise that if they do produce something that may have a commercial value, they'll be able to appropriate that value by selling it in the marketplace and not having others rip them off. So firstly, intellectual property laws encourage people to create, and everyday individuals are affected in that way by having a wider range of subject matter to consume. The other way in which intellectual property laws impact on everyday people is that it constrains what they can do with those products. When you buy a book, it's not the case that you can do absolutely anything you like with it. You are allowed to read it, you may be allowed to lend it, but you're certainly not allowed to copy it and sell it to others or rip off the ideas in there for commercial gain. So it operates to increase the number of works that we have for us to use, but it constrains what we can do with them.
Yes. The other commonly used public policy reason for intellectual property is that it encourages companies to invest, that without intellectual property rights, companies wouldn't have the confidence to go ahead and actually invest in new ideas, new technologies, and new creative artistic performance.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, again, copyright's a very good example. Like it or not, some big budget films in the US cost as much to create as a life-saving pharmaceutical drug does. In both cases, it's recognised that the investment wouldn't occur and we wouldn't get either the film or the drug without the fact that the law allows the creator to take exclusive rights to it and to recoup their investment through that exclusivity.
Now, they're the arguments we're hearing from the rich world. I'd like to bring Lawrence Liang into the conversation now. How do laws of intellectual property affect the people of India, Lawrence?
The key area in the Indian context where we've seen the adverse impact of intellectual property on the lives of people has been in the case of pharmaceuticals industry and access to drugs, because from 2005, with the Indian Patent Act being amended to allow for product patent on pharmaceuticals, we've seen the rise in the price of drugs in a number of areas. And a high court in South India has recently passed a very important judgment which looks at the impact of patents on one particular drug known as Gleevec, which was patented by Novartis, which is a very expensive cancer drug, where the price of the drug had shot up by 10 times after the amendment to the Patent Act.
Yes. Now, the patenting of drugs is a commonly heard problem for people in what we call the majority world, or a lot of people call the developing world. Let's move into information. We're in the information age. India is one of the leaders in forging that information age. Lawrence, what system of protection for the work of, for example, authors and film producers and artists would you like to see in place?
I'd like to see really a system that actually does promote the rights of creators and authors and inventors. But my doubt is about whether intellectual property as it stands today is that system. Because in copyright law, it's well recognized that the creators of works are rarely the owners of the works, right? So, whether it's the musicians or the writers, they actually rarely make their money completely from the works that they create. This is a system where the balance is completely tilted in favor of the owners of information and against the users of information or against public interest. And one of the groups that I work with, which is actually the leading English rock band in Bangalore, had an option of actually entering into an agreement with an entertainment major. But the terms of the agreement were so completely one-sided and not beneficial to this small little band that they decided to opt for an open content license, which allowed people to download their song for free, because they figured that their money was being made through shows and not from the sale of records. You know, so here's a scenario where one would have assumed that if you're a small music band, you would have just jumped at the opportunity of signing with an entertainment major. But clearly, the terms of the agreement are such that they don't actually work to the benefit of the creators of music. So the kind of system that I think, I would like in place is one which actually goes back to the origins of the intellectual property system, which is an attempt to create a balance between the promotion of public knowledge on the one hand and ensuring that creators have adequate returns. And I think that initiatives like the Creative Commons are ways of thinking about alternatives that attempt to restore this kind of balance that actually existed.
Andrew, companies versus people, companies versus artists, who really benefits from copyright and intellectual property?
Well, I think the people who benefit from it are those who achieve their financial and non-financial goals from it. I don't see it the way it sounds, as though Lawrence might be painting it, that the investors who support the artists and develop the market for them, who market them, who put their own reputation around the product, somehow aren't deserving of a return for that investment. But I do agree strongly with Lawrence that we do not want to kill the goose that lays the egg. We do want to make sure that the system rewards the creators. He says that. I agree with that. I'm perhaps less sceptical about the lack of contribution that the record companies make to bringing the product to market.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in the studios of community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, chatting to lawyers Lawrence Leong and Andrew Christie about crime's new frontier, cyberspace. We've just heard about the case of Hugh Griffiths, convicted for infringing the intellectual property rights of some of United States' big entertainment media moguls. Let's explore now the nature of his crime. More than 4 years jail for a crime like this seems steep to the ordinary person. Broadly speaking, what do you think justifies a sentence like this, Andrew?
The magnitude of the damage that his activities have allegedly caused. I think people listening at home would think it would seem steep if they equate it with them making a illegal copy of a sound recording lent to them by a friend, but they may not think it's so inappropriate if they think about somebody robbing a bank and taking off with money to that large amount, $1 million a year, whatever the figures are, they're very, very large in any currency. So I think when you think about the magnitude of the loss that these activities have allegedly caused, the jail term may not seem so large after all.
It's interesting. In this particular case, the actual cell that was involved, the Drink or Die group, a number of their members, including Hugh, were breaking the internet codes not to download the software, but to brag that they could crack the codes. However, at the trial that Hugh went through, the actual nominal amount of damage that was put on their activities was in the tens of millions of dollars. How does that work?
Yeah, look, I think one should be fairly cautious and sceptical when we hear copyright owners say that the value of the loss caused to them by infringement is X, where X is a very large number. Because what I think we could suspect they're doing is calculating the worst case scenario for them, that is to say something like that every download of a piece of music was a lost sale of that piece of music. But I think your listeners would recognise that's not the case. People often download music and they would never have bought it if they had to, and they may only listen to it once and they may then delete it. So we should be sceptical about the size of the loss that's caused, but we shouldn't be so sceptical as to assume that it's not worthy of serious investigation.
Lawrence, what was your view about the sentence that Hugh got?
I think it's just an outrage. I was completely shocked when I read it. Of course, it's not shocking or surprising that the U.S. would do this. A couple of points. More fundamentally, I think the larger question that is always ignored, precisely because the debate only takes place within the realm of the legal, is really the social benefits of piracy. You know, I mean, I'm not interested so much in the question of what piracy is, as much as I'm interested in the question of what piracy does. And I think the kind of democratization that it enabled, both in terms of technology, but also critically in terms of cultural forms, was vital to the emergence of a certain cultural diversity in music in India. So I'm actually a big supporter of piracy. Let me give you an interesting example of the Indian music industry. The Indian music industry, which was mainly dominated by HMV, and HMV was actually, you know, set up by the empire, remained the sole monopoly over music right up to the late 70s, controlling around 92% of the market in India. Now, the cultural implication of this monopoly was that a media empire can only cater to a mass market. What it ended up doing was creating a monopoly as well, with the emergence of one particular form, the Hindi film song, as the sole or the dominant aesthetic in India. But in the 70s, with the emergence of the cassette recorder, you know, the ubiquitous two-in-ones that a number of the migrant workers from India were returning with, particularly from countries like Dubai and other countries in the Middle East, you had the emergence of this kind of media revolution of sorts, where smaller people entered into the fray and started producing content, both legal as well as illegal, pirate activities as well as legal activities, which actually, in a matter of 7 years, broke the monopoly of HMV, and they went from 92% of the market share to around 40% of the market share. But more importantly, what it did was resurrected languages like Punjabi, Gharwali, Kumaoni, in music cultures, which had actually been killed by HMV. You know, so even though you could say that all of these were acts of piracy and that they indeed caused great losses to HMV, I really don't have a problem with that. So the heart of the issue really is the fact that we're talking about global media empires whose effects have been horrible. I mean, there are only 6 countries in the world where the local film industry is larger than Hollywood. The rest of the countries in the world are dominated by Hollywood. This is the kind of cultural hegemony that's taking place. And so when Hollywood loses a couple of $1 billion, I don't lose too much sleep over it. Yes. I think it's perfectly all right.
What you're talking about is just as much a product of monopolization of the media industry as it is about intellectual property rights, though, isn't it?
Absolutely. Media empires would not be sustained were it not for, you know, the coming into place of complex licensing mechanisms. You know, so I think the linkages between the industry and piracy is also something that needs to be spoken about. You know, so it's interesting that the U.S. makes such a big hue and cry about intellectual property piracy, given that the industrial history of the U.S. is tied centrally to intellectual property piracy from Europe. The word Yankee, for example, is actually from Dutch for the word pirate. And there's some fascinating histories that have been done for this.
So, Andrew Christie, piracy encouraging information flows or discouraging creative endeavours?
Possibly both. Look, I think Lawrence, I and all your listeners aspire to the same outcome. We all want greater accessibility to things like computers and life-saving drugs. Where I think maybe Lawrence and I don't agree is what's the problem, what's blocking that, and what's the solution to that blocking? I would say that more often than not, intellectual property is not the problem. And even if it was a contributor to the problem, the solution doesn't necessarily lie in changing our IP laws, but doing something different. Can I just give you an example? Because drugs is a good one. Here in Australia, we're a developed country, very developed country. We have drug prices that are significantly lower than the US, yet we have the same patent law. Why are our drug prices lower? The answer is we have a centralised purchasing system, a monopsony, to use the economist's jargon. The government basically buys on behalf of every Australian and uses its purchasing power to buy very low and therefore sell low. if we had a problem with access to medicines and we didn't have that monopsony system, I'd be suggesting we introduce it. And indeed in the US, people who think the drug prices are too high are suggesting just exactly that. So I would say generally don't go rushing around seeing intellectual property as the cause of the problem. It often isn't. But even if it's a contributor, it'll be a partial one, the solution is probably not in changing the IP laws, but looking at making access available.
Lawrence, what's your view?
Oh, I think I have a lot to disagree with Andrew, but let me begin with where I agree with him. I agree with him that the patent system is not the only problem when we're speaking about public health and access to drugs. In India, for example, a huge hassle that we have is distribution. So even when generic drugs are actually available at a very low cost, what you had is the problem of distribution has also been largely caused at some level because of the kind of marketing that pharmaceutical companies have engaged in. The provision of what are known in the, you know, the public health debates as the free lunches. And this is a huge rise because you've seen in the past around 10 years a rise in the budget of marketing from an average of 16% of the budget of a pharmaceutical company to something like 32% of the budget of a company.
Wow.
Has meant that doctors have stopped prescribing generic drugs. Doctors only prescribe, you know, kind of patented drugs or branded drugs. Right? So these are problems that have to be seen together.
We could explore that particular question for, I think, another quarter of an hour, but I want to get back to Hugh Griffith's case. Lawrence, you were saying that you thought that the sentence he'd received was outrageous. Can you tell us a little bit more about your opinion about that?
My first objection is, of course, to the entire criminalization of non-legal media practices, right? I mean, that's where I would begin. My second objection would be to, of course, the length of the sentence. And the third, of course, is the fact that, you know, the U.S. actually extradited him. And I think there's a serious problem out here because, you know, if you were to take, let me make a confession here, which might be at my own peril in the future. as a researcher, I am dependent on journals and law reviews, right? And it's impossible for me in India, sitting in India, to actually access journals and law reviews because of the prohibitive cost. If I wanted to, for example, download a single article from one of the proprietary databases, I would have to shell out something like $25 or $30, right? Because around 1/15th of my salary. Now, it's a little absurd for you to imagine that, you know, I would be spending 1/15th of my monthly salary on a single article that I wanted to download. So you rely on a large kind of, you know, informal network of people who do have access to these articles, sending you these articles, right? So at one level, what you're really talking about here is, in some senses, the fundamental right to knowledge and to culture. And I think when people actually enable this and they are labeled as pirates, we need to be a little cautious because, as you know, Toni Morrison has reminded us, definitions belong to the definer, not the defined. Mm. So this idea of naming someone using the word pirate or the word terrorist to name someone's illegality is always from the perspective of what the legal order stands for. And I think that if the legal order is fundamentally unjust, there is no problem in disobeying it. And we've learned this in India from Mahatma Gandhi, who taught us that it was not just your duty to disobey an unjust law, but it was a fundamental ethical obligation that was cast upon you. Of course, media empires would create massive amounts of anxiety about losses and about, you know, the criminalized language of piracy and terrorism. But as people interested in the larger question of justice, we need to take these very, very critically. Mm. So the Hugh Griffiths case for me is an example where the punishment is more to set an example than anything else.
Andrew?
I disagree with Lawrence. I think that the fact is that I doubt anyone would object to his colleagues in India sending him a copy of an article, and even if they did it once a month or a number of times a month. But I think when one small group does do things on a very large scale, and of course the internet, which is the contributor to this whole issue, allows that to happen, there is a difference. Criminalisation of copyright law, for example, it works like this. It doesn't say that every copyright infringement is both a civil and a criminal offence. It says that every copyright infringement is a civil offence. And certain types of civil infringements are also criminal if they're done on a very large scale for profit, for commercial purposes.
Well, there wasn't any profit here.
There was.
Well, that's not true in India. That's not true in India because even For example, the possession of illegal software is a civil and criminal offence, regardless of whether there's commercial motivation for the distribution of that software.
Yeah, I'm sure it can vary from country to country, but in the US, for example, it's a criminal offence to infringe copyright willfully and commercially, on a commercial scale, for profit. Now, you say no profit here. Well, I'll stand advised on that. But the point was, there was commercial loss here. Somebody was profiting. If not Hugh Griffith, then the people who were downloading his software for free were profiting, because they were getting something for free. We do treat, as societies, activities done by groups or its individuals that cause large loss as something much more heinous than a whole lot of little losses done by individuals.
Yes, but I think what Ashcroft's comments actually indicate is that America is corralling information and culture at the moment, is actually going to rely on it substantially for returns to its GDP, for its employment, and will protect that patch with whatever it takes. As a consequence, there is an issue here about who owns information and ideas, and is it legitimate to actually keep the majority world down by actually demanding a price for it from the rich world?
Well, I suspect it isn't fair to do that to the majority world, and you won't find me saying they should. In a sense, the reason that Hugh Griffiths was sought by the Americans is because the substance of the loss he caused was in America. Maybe people in India were downloading his games too and getting them for free, but I bet you the American copyright owners didn't see that as the real problem. They saw the real problem being people in developed, rich countries not paying. So maybe you get the outcome that Lawrence was talking about, where Microsoft is not too worried about copyright infringement of its stuff in China in the first instance. I don't mind if copyright owners choose not to sue. That's great. But it's a different thing to say we're going to force them not to sue by not treating criminal infringement of copyright as a criminal offence.
Hmm. Can I give you an example on this?
Yes, please do.
There is an ongoing case in the Delhi High Court that we've been following and tracking, which involves the eight entertainment majors, from 20th Century Fox to TriStar and Universal, etc., constituting something like $535 billion, of income a year. And they've sued a proprietor of a small music store that was selling pirated DVDs, whose annual turnover is like 2 lakhs a year, or around approximately $5,000 annually, right? And the plaint is very interesting, because it makes precisely the kind of claim, that Andrew's suggesting, because it says that a single copy of this film will cause irreparable loss and damage to the entertainment industry in the US.
Indeed. Andrew, would you like to comment?
Oh, I simply have sympathy with Lawrence's scepticism there. I think, I think patronising as this sounds to the Americans, I think the Americans are doing themselves a great disservice in pursuing that type of case.
Yes.
Just as I think they have in the US pursuing the college students, where they've been not engaging on huge scale piracy. But with the Hugh Griffith case, I do think I understand exactly why they're taking their very strong action, because they are qualitatively different, because they're quantitatively different. The effect of Hugh Griffith's actions were felt way beyond Australia, felt a whole lot of countries around the world, and a lot in the US, and that was because he used this wonderful tool, the internet. The reality is going to be, it's no longer good enough to say, I'm not in America doing something, I'm sitting here in Australia keyboard, if, and it always is the case, if the effect is going to be felt in the US. So yes, the borders come down, but not because of some sort of knee-jerk reaction to the horror of this, as we might think about terrorism, but simply because of the technology means the borders aren't there.
These are the two greatest anxieties of the contemporary, right? I mean, if it's immigration and the movement of people across borders and intellectual property piracy mark the contemporary in interesting ways, and they also alert us to the fact that both these fictions, the fiction of the border and the fiction of intangible kind of, property as losses, can only be sustained by the might of the law and by the might of a military police state, right? I mean, if it weren't for the fact that you had the military police state enforcing borders, borders have become rather meaningless in the contemporary. If it weren't for the fact that you have intellectual property laws that define acts of sharing of information and culture as being criminal or being piracy, there would be no restrictions on the replication or the spreading of culture and knowledge across the world. And really, in some ways, both these fictions of the border and of property in the domain of the intangibles alerts us to the extraordinary linkage between police power and the power of capital in the contemporary.
Andrew, Lawrence, that was fabulous. We covered a hell of a lot of territory today. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. It was very, very interesting and very spirited.
Thanks a lot. Great being on the show and talking to you guys as well.
That was Lawrence Leong from Bangalore, India, who's the legal lead for Creative Commons in India and a prolific contributor to intellectual policy debate through the Alternative Law Forum in India, both online. Also talking with us was Professor Andrew Christie, who's the Davies Collison Cave Professor of Intellectual Property at the University of Melbourne here in Australia, who sits on committees to advise the Australian Government on intellectual property. Thank you both very much for being with us today.
Great. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Andrew.
Yeah, nice chatting with you, Lawrence. Thanks.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, being broadcast through radios, computers, and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. Today, we're talking about crime's new frontiers, cybercrime. We've just heard about the case of Hugh Griffiths, who belonged to a group, Drink or Die, which cracked company codes that had the potential to allow them to download software and games free of the normal charge. Well, free of charge until he was raided in Australia and, at the request of the United States government, charged with having committed US crimes and sent to Virginia, where he was tried, then sentenced to over 4 years jail. He spent 3 years in jail awaiting trial in Australia, and he'll be serving the rest of his sentence in a Virginian jail. It used to be that if you committed an offence, you'd be tried and convicted in the country where the offence took place. After all, criminal law is about offending the rules of your surrounding community, not the rules of people thousands of miles away. But the United States now wants to try and punish certain types of offenders itself. Terrorism, it says, knows no boundaries. And neither, so it seems, will cybercrimes. Stephen Kenny knows all about how the United States deals with people from other countries it wants locked away. Stephen was one of the first lawyers to reveal what was happening at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, where the United States took over the treatment of more than 600 people from other countries that it said were terrorists. He was David Hicks' first lawyer, and although he left the Hicks team in 2005, he went on to bring home three other Australian citizens detained in the War on Terror. Stephen, first of all, what do you make of this practice of the United States wanting to try and punish people for crimes done in other countries?
I find that of serious concern. I mean, I think they would be better off working with other countries to ensure that if their citizens are committing offences that impact on the United States, that those offences are taken into account in those other countries. I have some serious concerns about Americans really imposing their own law on the rest of the world. It's like they run it perhaps as the British saw their empire once. In Hugh's case, I'm not sure that Australia couldn't have prosecuted him for what he was doing in Australia, under Australian law. That would have seemed to have been the acceptable thing to do. The idea of taking people from one country into the United States to prosecute them in a foreign land where, I mean, fortunately he at least speaks English, but many may not, to imprison him miles from his family, seems to me to be an unreasonable manner to treat people. Let's assume, say, the Japanese or the Chinese or some other country decide they wanted him for committing a crime against their law, which would mean that, you know, you could end up anywhere in the world just being extradited because you have committed a crime against some other law that you have no contemplation of.
New South Wales Chief Judge in Equity, Peter Young, has reportedly described as bizarre the fact that people are being extradited to the United States to face criminal charges when they have never been to the United States and the alleged act occurred wholly outside the United States. You were a lawyer here based in Australia. You were retained by the Hicks family when David was arrested and then taken to Guantanamo Bay without charge for many years. What problems did you encounter being in Australia as a lawyer, trying to run a case for the defence of somebody who was over in Cuba?
Well, some very major ones. If David had been a multimillionaire, it might not have been so bad. Lawyers are pretty much for hire for money anywhere around the world, and the rules are pretty much the same. However, if you've got no money and shortly after September 11 you want to sue George Bush and the US military, I can tell you it's pretty difficult. I spent many late nights on the telephone to law firms in the United States who had large pro bono legal practices where they had this, you know, duty to help the poor and underprivileged and had wonderful websites and things like that about what they did. But strangely enough, at that time of the year, they were all extremely busy. The other difficulty is, of course, finding the right lawyers. I mean, there are many lawyers, but there are a lesser number of very, very good lawyers who can do a particularly difficult job. And so it's a combination of looking for the right lawyer who's good at what you want them to do with no money in a foreign country for a terrorist who is not exactly popular over there. It was very difficult. It took me a while.
Yeah. And in terms of the quality of the defence that you actually get then, that distance, does it actually cut down in any way a defendant's right to a fair trial or defendant's rights to...
It is extremely difficult, particularly, and I've represented other Australians detained in the war on terror in other countries around the world. The Hicks case in Guantanamo Bay was high enough profile that people took an interest in it. But the other ones I've dealt with are just as equally serious and, in fact, probably even more serious because... certainly, in a couple of the cases, they really had nothing to do with any group that may be considered in any way connected to the war on terror. So they were complete innocents, and nobody was particularly interested in them. You know, I wasn't able to find lawyers in other countries to represent them. So in a situation where you're trying to work for somebody in a foreign country and you don't have millions of dollars behind you, it's almost impossible.
The other thing that strikes me as a similarity between the cases that you're talking about, I mean, Ahmad Jamal, who you represented, was actually allegedly being tortured by the Kurds in Iraq, where he was being held. It's very difficult for you if there are lapses in the standard of detention facing your client to do anything about it too. I mean, in terms of Hugh Griffith, he's been in a cell, and whilst it's not Guantanamo Bay, the cell that he was first in when he was sentenced in Virginia was a cell meant for two men in which three men were sleeping.
Ahmed Rafiq, another Australian who was detained in Iraq, was in Abu Ghraib during General Miller's regime. And I mean, all you can do is try and push the officials to visit them as often as possible. And I won't identify which one I was dealing with, but Hicks' case, for example, officials came back and reported to the family that David was getting regular meals, regular exercise, and had a room of his own. Now, the meals were absolutely appalling. The room of his own was solitary confinement, and the regular exercise was a half an hour once a week at night.
Yes.
And one of the other ones in Iraq, they refused to raise this treatment with authorities because, you know, the person being detained was scared that if they raised any complaint about being bashed up and mistreated, but as soon as the Australians left, it would happen again. Mm. And the Australian government didn't have enough guts to sort of stand up to these people and say, no, come on, we are here helping you in this country. This is the standard that you need to meet.
And I suppose what you've just outlined is another problem, really, and that's that the family have to deal with Department of Foreign Affairs officials to actually know what is happening to their loved one, whereas if they were incarcerated in their own country, they would be actually able just to go and visit.
That's right. And what I try and do to get around that is to get the DFAT officials to take a satellite phone with them, but sometimes the authorities let them use it and sometimes they don't. And it's a serious concern because not all these people who are overseas and are being detained are guilty. I mean, some of them are innocent, but simply awaiting trial.
The other complicating factor for Hugh Griffith is that although he lived in Australia since he was 7 years old as a permanent resident, without being charged with any offence in Australia whatsoever, the Australian government says that his permanent resident status has lapsed. So effectively, this means he may never be able to get back into the country where he's grown up and where his family, including a sick father, live. So far as the Australian government's concerned, this seems a completely disproportionate punishment, particularly when he's never been charged with any offence there. As a civil libertarian, Stephen, what do you make of this use of immigration law as a parallel tool for punishment?
Well, to be honest, I just about can't find the words of disappointment and disgust I feel about it. I mean, here's a person who was 7 years old when he came out to this country, never really lived anywhere else, has no other home. This is his home. It shows the manner in which prisoners are being ill-treated, and that's what it is, if he is then sent back to live in England and can never come back to Australia where he's grown up. I mean, he is not a person who is beyond redemption. There is no suggestion of that. I'm sure after he's done his time, he's very unlikely to ever reoffend again. It's almost the old convict mentality, you know, that you know, we should deport these people somewhere else and stick them on a rock pretending we live in England 200 years ago. It's totally unacceptable, and I really think any government that does that should be voted out of office.
That was Australian-based lawyer Stephen Kenny. Great, Stephen. Thank you very much for your time today. Really good to speak to you again.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. Keep it up. I mean, you just got to keep plugging away.
Absolutely. We try. We try. And great to talk with you today too. Before we go, let's thank Radio New Internationalist Associate Producer Rachel Maher for her contribution to today's program. Great job, Rachel. Now, if you're wondering about the music that you've been hearing through this program, it comes from the Riverboat Records series. In the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Indian musician Debashish Bhattacharya is starring this week, with his three guitars, a trinity of guitars that he designed himself. In Indian cosmology, the trinity is a powerful symbol. For instance, Trinetra, transcript for three eyes, represents past, present, and future. Together, the guitars straddle the styles of 1,000 years of Indian music. The result? The CD Calcutta Slide Guitar. It's already attracting award nominations. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find copies of this program just waiting to be downloaded onto a computer or iPod near you. I'm Chris Richards. Let's hook up again next week.